Benti with your worldwide news update. Human Rights Watch said in a report released Thursday that Israel has committed war crimes and crimes against humanity in the Gaza Strip, including massive forced displacements that amount to ethnic cleansing. Around 90% of the territory's population has fled their homes, with many displaced multiple times. A new report released by the New York-based rights group said people have been killed while evacuating under Israeli orders and in Israeli-designated humanitarian zones, where hundreds of thousands are crammed into squalid tent camps. Israel has not yet commented on the report. It declared war on Hamas after the militant group's October 7th terrorist attacks on Israel. As President-elect Donald Trump continues to announce his cabinet nominations, it is clear loyalty rather than experience is paramount in his choices. Matt Gaetz once faced a sex trafficking investigation by the Justice Department he could now lead. AP's Lisa Dwyer has more.
Gaetz submitted his resignation from Congress, launching an 8-week clock to fill his seat. It also ends a long-running ethics investigation. Gaetz was under scrutiny by the House Ethics Committee over allegations that included sexual misconduct. Justice Department's investigation into sex trafficking allegations involving underage girls ended last year with no federal charges against him. By stepping down, the bipartisan panel no longer has jurisdiction over Gaetz, rendering the probe and the subsequent report effectively dead. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
This COP is about the world.
France's ecology minister pulled out of the UN climate summit COP29 over unacceptable remarks by Azeri President Ilham Aliyev. Aliyev used a speech on Wednesday to attack Paris for alleged colonial crimes and human rights violations in its overseas territories, notably in the troubled Pacific archipelago of New Caledonia. French Environment Minister Agnès Pannier-Runacher slammed the remarks as deplorable and said she was canceling her trip to Baku. This is VOA News. U.S., Japanese, and South Korean naval forces held joint exercises in East Asian waters on Thursday, their most complex and final joint drills before President Joe Biden hands over one of his signature national security initiatives to Donald Trump.
So this is a multidimensional, multi-year exercise that all three countries, not three leaders, committed to.
Visiting the USS George Washington carrier, U.S. Ambassador to Japan Rahm Emanuel said the three-way pact and the resulting military cooperation sent a strong message to Beijing.
If you look at the region and you want to project deterrence, you want to ensure the security of America's interests, it's better to have allies. Because remember, in this area and region, we have a lot of allies and China does not.
For Seoul, said South Korean Rear Admiral Ho Sung-jae, who commanded his country's forces. The exercise, which came after North Korea last month tested what it claims was an upgraded intercontinental ballistic missile, sent a message to its belligerent neighbor. United Nations Nuclear Chief Rafael Grossi held a joint news conference with the head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Mohammad Islami, during a visit to Tehran.
Nuclear facilities should not be subject to military attack. There can be very serious radiological consequences to such attacks.
His visit comes just days after Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said Iran was, quote, more exposed than ever to strikes on its nuclear facilities, unquote, giving Israel, quote, the opportunity to achieve our most important goal, unquote. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said Thursday that Iran will not negotiate under intimidation as he held crunch talks with the UN nuclear chief. The South African government says it won't help 4,000 illegal miners inside a closed mine. AP correspondent Donna Water reports.
Some 4,000 illegal miners in a mine shaft in South Africa's northwest province are believed to be suffering from a lack of food, water, and other basic necessities after police closed off the entrances used to transport their supplies underground. The South African government says it will not send any help to illegal miners because they're involved in a criminal act, and the government wants to smoke them out, forcing them to return to the surface where they're arrested. The government says many illegal miners come from neighboring countries and are responsible for violent crimes in neighboring communities. I'm Donna Water.
A Hong Kong court on Thursday sentenced Ng Chi Hung, the mastermind of a failed bomb plot during anti-government protests in December 2019, to nearly 24 years in jail. He was among seven convicted people who appeared in court for their roles in the foiled plan to plant two bombs and shoot officers along a rally route. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Christina Menenti, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight,
on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News tonight.
Given that 1.5 threshold will be overshoot almost certainly, then the discussion is whether we will be able to go under it by the end of the century. And the path to it gets narrower and narrower by the minute.
At this year's climate summit, that was Copernicus director Carlo Bonotempo on our planet, having already hit 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, which is a critical threshold. Details coming up also. Election observers have urged Somaliland's president candidates and their supporters to accept the result. And a rights group says armored vehicles made by the UAE and equipped with French defense systems have been captured in Sudan. These stories and more on Africa News tonight. Our top story at COP29, the United Nations Climate Summit underway in Azerbaijan. World leaders are contemplating a deal to give billions of dollars to help poor countries reduce and adapt to climate change. Carlo Bonotempo, director of Copernicus, the European Climate Change Service, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the goal remains the same as the first conference 30 years ago in Berlin: increase international ambition to reduce global warming below 1.5 Celsius to avoid catastrophic harm to the planet.
The evidence is very clear on where we are and which trajectory we are climate-wise, and what the responsibilities are. So what are the drivers behind the new record temperature we are seeing? So given that the science is so evident I'm a physicist by training, so maybe I'm simple-minded in some respect, but I would think, you know, given that we know the greenhouse gases play a fundamental role in this record-breaking temperature and in this change in the climate we are observing, then removing these extra greenhouse gases seems to be the logical consequence. And in that sense, I'm hopeful that the discussion at COP, not only this year, but every time, every single COP, and for the future, will be based on the evidence we have coming out of observation and model on what to do.
Copernicus issued a recent report saying this will likely be the hottest year in human history, but also that the world is on pace for a 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming. What does that mean in terms of global warming? You know, we've heard before, we can't get beyond 1.5 Celsius or there's just no turning back. But some people might take that to say, oh, we're actually doing pretty good.
Well, the fact that we are already at 1.5 and the discussion is whether to keep 1.5 alive, clearly we are talking about two slightly different things, because the 1.5 that the Paris Agreement refers to is an average over 20 years, and no likely would 2024 will become the first year, single year, above 1.5 as a calendar year. So we are not quite at the Paris Agreement threshold, but it's true that we are approaching it very rapidly. And in all likelihood, that threshold will be passed either at the end of this decade or early next decade. So given that 1.5 threshold will be overshoot almost certainly, then the discussion is whether we will be able to go under it by the end of the century. And the path to it gets narrower and narrower by the minute. So in a sense, I don't think we are on a good path if our goal is the one of keeping 1.5 alive. So I think it's important to stress this element. It's always up to us to decide. It's not that someone will decide for us. It's every single citizen or policymakers, at the end, the policymaker represent us in their decision. It's our responsibility to decide what to do. And if we want to keep the 2 degrees or the 1.5 degrees alive, well, we need to change something, because the trajectory you're following at the moment is not leading to that.
The effects of climate change and disasters like hurricanes, droughts, floods, we've seen a lot of droughts and floods in Africa with that type of severity and increasing frequency that just hasn't been seen before. Should that be setting off alarm bells for world leaders, heads of state, other people that are attending COP29? And is that happening this year?
Well, the language of the alarm bell has been used for decades now. So if we want to use the same metaphor, then I would say that we have been ringing this bell for a very long time and with very little effect. Going back to the science, I guess it's important to say that some of these extremes, especially the heat waves. We have seen a lot of occurrences of those lately, or hydrological extreme. But not only that, if you look even just in Europe over the last few months, we had flooding in Italy, in Czechia, in Poland, and last year in Greece and Libya, and so on. These kind of events that are often linked to a very intense precipitation, very intense rainfall in a short amount of time. Well, these kind of events are increasing in intensity because of climate change. The science is quite clear on that. And actually, the science behind is probably a century and a half old. And if we want to base our decisions on evidence, then I think there is something to be alarmed because these are likely to go worse from now on.
That's Carlo Bonatempo, director of Copernicus, the European Climate Change Service. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Damme from Bonn, Germany. Tomorrow, Bonatempo talks about what ordinary people can do to help reduce global warming. The UN's COP29 meeting in Azerbaijan has been dubbed the Climate Finance Summit for its central goal to agree on how much money should go each year to help developing countries cope with climate-related costs. That discussion could be tough following the re-election of former U.S. President Donald Trump. During his 2017-2021 term in the White House, Trump withdrew from the landmark Paris Agreement on curbing global warming. Joseph Siegel, director of research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi how that could impact the African nation's demand for more climate change financing.
The new administration is likely to take a more skeptical position on climate financing. It's important to remember that the U.S. is just one country in this global effort to adapt to and mitigate more effect extreme weather events that the world's facing. Many countries, many industrialized countries, are having a hard time coming up with the financing to adapt to the effects of climate change domestically, let alone internationally. And this is one of the reasons why the Green Climate Fund has been so slow to reach its target funding levels. And it's one of the key issues at the current COP29. It's also leading to some other innovative climate investment initiatives being put forward at last year's COP. Brazil put forward an idea called the Tropical Forest Forever Facility. And the idea is to create a large fund that is supported by capital from investors. So it's not a grant, but it's investment that then would generate a fixed rate of return, like a bond. But the fund would in turn be reinvested and would then create revenues that could lead to a steady funding stream. They're estimating about $4 billion a year for countries that are a part of this effort, in this case to protect the tropical forest. Similar funds could be used to help mitigate against the impacts from climate change. And so I think part of the discussion we're going to see at COP29 is an exploration of other initiatives to generate sustainable revenues that are going to be mutually sustainable from both investors and countries in Africa.
In 2023 alone, climate change-related events claimed over 23,000 lives across Africa, from devastating floods in Kenya, which killed more than 20 people and destroyed properties worth millions of dollars, to relentless heat waves and tropical cyclones in Mozambique. Would these climate events in Africa boost African nations' chance to getting more finance out of COP29?
Well, the extreme weather events we're seeing in Africa and around the globe are reinforcing the recognition on a monthly basis that, you know, this threat is real and it's at hand. And no longer are we talking about a far away predicted threat, but now we're talking about a clear and present danger that is going to require adaptations. And it is this reality that is going to underscore the urgency of policy action. And so I believe it will put these issues more front and center. And, you know, the bottom line is that these problems are not going to go away. They're going to continue to be with us. They're going to continue to make headlines. And those events are going to demand solutions.
Africa is the continent most affected by fallout from climate change while contributing least to carbon emissions. Do African leaders have a united front to raise issues like climate security and climate financing at COP29?
One of the takeaways we're seeing already from COP29 is the unprecedented levels of collaboration among the African countries. We've seen, you know, strong statements by a wide range of leaders, including from Republic of Congo, Cote d'Ivoire, Kenya, and it is, you know, further reinforced by the fact that you do have so many African heads of state attending the conference. And so, you know, this reveals that there is a growing recognition of the depth of the threat faced on the continent, and it is leading to more dialogue and brainstorming on possible ways forward. And I think so many of the initiatives that are out there are revolving around energy sector and coming up with new investments for supporting Africa's energy sector. It may be a way of both addressing some of the climate threats as well as helping to boost Africa's economic potential and making Africa a leader in green energy development. This in turn will have, you know, huge effects for delivering affordable electricity, improving health outcomes, lowering the cost for energy for millions of Africans, and has the potential to create more jobs and a more secure energy future. So I think looking at those sorts of types of initiatives on the energy sector may be a way to use that united front from the continent to generate sustainable financing that's going to be needed to fund this transition.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. Warmer weather and unpredictable rain patterns caused by climate change are affecting communities all over Africa. Reporter Ruben Chama speaks with people in Nairobi about climate change as world leaders debate the way forward at the COP29 summit. Most climate scientists say emissions from burning coal, oil, and gas in developed countries have led to a warmer earth. Timothy Larpi is a member of the pastoralist Maasai community. He says climate change is reducing the water and grass available for their livestock and traditional ways of life.
If you look at the pastoral community, due to the shrinking landscapes caused by drying up of rivers, the farmer communities are doing a lot of cultivation along the rivers, and therefore there is no water downstream. The water does not reach the pastoral communities in those sites due to the heavy commercial crop production in the upper regions, and therefore this has affected and reduced the number of stock that a pastoralist could keep. And this has really driven people to poverty. Our government should do something about it. There should be legislations in place to protect the pastoral landscape. To prevent further fragmentation and subdivision of land into plots, the government should set certain area as reserve lands for pastoral community, as either pasture land, so that that area cannot be subdivided, nobody can settle it, and that way we will have empowered pastoral communities.
Virginia Kingu is a sociologist in Nairobi, and she sees the effects of climate change among many communities.
Initially, the community would predict the weather, like where the short rains between November and December, the long rains between March and May, and the rest time of the year was dry. The farmers knew what to plant and when. Right now, the weather has become so unpredictable and is affecting most community members. We have experienced longer and more frequent dry periods, which have led to food insecurity, loss of livestock, depletion of water, increase of arid and semi-arid areas, and also clashes between the pastoral community for pasture. We have also seen swarms of locusts destroy drought-resistant crops and trees. Due to climatic change, the rainfall patterns have also changed. We have seen short and intense rains, which are catastrophic. They have led to loss of lives, displacement, and landslides.
Virginia Kingu also thinks the government should help communities by investing more in weather forecasting. Yakim Santum Kuraru manages a community conservancy group in Laikipia County. He says some of the Maasai-speaking pastoralist communities are struggling to adapt to changing weather.
There's also a lot of land degradation, Right now in Mayanath, we are doing the restoration. We have a number of invasive species that have come up after the rains came back. So we find that these climatic changes, they are affecting the community. As a community, I've also started to change the way of life, something that is very foreign to us, for example, growing crops. We are also being faced still with a challenge on those crops that we are growing because of the elephants. We have elephants roaming around the homesteads. This is really affecting the Ma community at large. We are very optimistic that this COP29 is going to do something, probably fund communities, direct funding that should be coming direct to the communities. It's my hope that this COP29, they are going to give some good solutions to African countries.
We'll have more reporting in the coming days on the COP29 summit and how African nations are battling climate change on all our programs and also on voaafrica.com. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. Every Wednesdays, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. The rights group Amnesty International today said armored vehicles manufactured by the United Arab Emirates and equipped with French defense systems have been captured by the Sudanese army during the civil war in Sudan. The rights group said the paramilitary rapid support forces, or RSF, used the UAE-made armored personnel carriers in various parts of Sudan in its fight with the Sudanese armed forces. Amnesty says the presence of the military vehicles could be a violation of a United Nations arms embargo on Sudan. France's Arms Export Authority told the French news agency AFP it had not seen the Amnesty report and declined to comment. The makers of the French systems also did not comment. The UAE has denied the reports it sells arms to the RSF and says it supports humanitarian efforts to help civilian war victims. The war broke out in April 2023, and the UN has called Sudan the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with more than 25 million Sudanese facing extreme hunger. At least 20,000 people have died, and the UN estimates nearly 12 million have been displaced. Western diplomats who were in Somaliland to witness elections yesterday have urged the three presidential candidates and their supporters to accept the result as vote counting continues. The diplomats said they visited 30 polling stations in different cities to reaffirm their support for the democratic process. The diplomats from 10 countries, including the U.S., U.K., Germany, Denmark, and Sweden, said they stand ready to work alongside Somaliland to further strengthen democracy and accountability in the future. International observers in Somaliland said the elections were peaceful, although some polling stations did not open due to conflict. Tim Cole, the chief observer of the International Election Observation Mission in Somaliland, who is leading a team of 28 international observers, told VOA's Horn of Africa service that they visited 146 polling stations. They saw some administrative issues and in some places procedures were not followed, but observed that people generally wanted to participate enthusiastically in the election.
We had 28 observers here throughout the whole of Somaliland yesterday observing the elections. We were in all six regions with people as far west as the Aldal province on the border with Djibouti, plus going east to El Afwein, and then north up to Berbera on the coast, and then south down to the Ethiopian border. So we had people all over the country. And we observed the elections starting with the opening of the polling stations in the morning. It's They were there at 6:30 to see the opening at 7 o'clock. And they then observed throughout their region, so driving to different polling stations, spending about 30 minutes in each polling station. Then they observed the closing of the polling stations and then the counting of the votes. And they also then followed the ballot box to the district centres where the votes are due to be tabulated, counted.
So did the election take place in a fair and transparent manner?
I can't comment on that yet because we haven't seen the whole election throughout the whole country. I mean, we're still only halfway through the elections. I mean, the votes are still coming back to the district centres. So in those district centres, they have to be tallied. They have to be added together. So we're still only partway through the elections themselves. I mean, our observers saw elections in 146 different polling stations. So in those, we saw some administrative issues. Some places, procedures weren't followed. But in general, people wanted to participate and the elections were peaceful. There was enthusiasm for voting. And as I said, it was peaceful. But we're only a part way through the whole elections process. So we can't comment on anything else.
What were the main challenges that was faced by the voters?
Well, in some parts of Somaliland, obviously, the polling stations didn't open because of conflict. So that's one issue that some voters faced. There were long queues, which can be seen as a good thing, but it also means people are standing around for a long time. But yeah, the main challenges were really, I would say there were some procedural issues, as I said, you know. Some of the polling stations, for example, didn't open as early as they should have done. They were due to open at 7 o'clock and they opened later. That was also true in the capital, Hargeisa.
And when are the official results going to be known?
So, as I said, the tallying or the tabulation hasn't yet started. That's due to start in Hargeisa in about an hour's time, 4:30, 5 o'clock this afternoon, we think. And that's when they take all those ballot boxes that they got from different parts of the region and they start adding them all up. So they then receive, I think it's on Saturday, so in 2 days' time, the results from the different regions around. Then the national results will be known sometime next week. And the National Electoral Commission makes preliminary announcements and then the Supreme Court has to confirm them. So it will be sometime next week before we know the final results. So I'm not sure exactly which day that could be because all of those things can take time or could be done very quickly depending on, you know, logistics, cars breaking down, all those sorts of things that can happen in any country. So it could be a few days yet before we get the final results.
That was Tim Cole, the chief observer of the International Election Observation Mission Somaliland, speaking with VOA's Horn of Africa service.
VOA. VOA Africa has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.
And Mali's military government arrested one of the country's top politicians Wednesday for criticizing the military rulers of neighboring Burkina Faso. The Associated Press reports Issa Kaou Ndjim was arrested on charges of insulting a foreign head of state. Mali and Burkina Faso have been ruled by military governments since coups in 2020 and 2022. Ndjim was one of the vice presidents of the National Transitional Council, Mali's legislative body under the military. He later distanced himself from the government and said he favored a return to electoral democracy. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.